Good morning, welcome to the Full Tonus Breakfast on Sound Art Radio 102.5 FM with myself, Peter Shearn, on, what is it? It's Tuesday, the 24th of August, 2021. And, still, due to the pandemic, still doing this show from home in the centre of Tonus, underneath the, what's it called? St. Mary's Church. Yes, and it's very quiet and it's very lovely here. Very lucky to live in such a lovely spot. And let's just get on with the show, because I don't know what I'm talking about. John Anderson will be joining us today. Now then, I learned something about Mr. John Anderson. He is a UK citizen and also an American. And he is a journalist in the world of finance. So he knows about the way money markets work and that sort of thing. And what I didn't know, though, was that he also was a speechwriter for the US ambassador to the UK. And so it seems really fitting to have a word with him about this special relationship between the UK and America. Is it still a thing? John is joining us soon, and he's chosen a couple of tracks for us to listen to. And I think I'm going to play the Brandy Carlile, and this is The Times They Are A-Changing. And so go ahead, Brandy, do your thing.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, well then you'd better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are changing. All you writers and critics who prophesize with your pens, yeah, well, keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin. And there's no telling who that it's naming, for the loser right now might be later to win. And the times, they are a-changing. All you senators and congressmen, please heed the call. Don't you stand in your doorway, don't lock up your halls, for he who gets hurt will be he who has stalled. And that battle outside that's raging will soon be rattling your windows and shaking your walls, for the times, they are a-changing. You can't
I would say that is a full-blooded performance of the Bob Dylan song by Belinda Carlisle. Brandy Carlisle, totally different person. Good morning, John. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Peter. Always a pleasure to be on the show with you.
It's a joy to welcome you back. We haven't heard your dulcet tones for so long now. We're missing it badly. So good to hear you back again.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, I didn't know. I knew about the financial reporting that you do. Wouldn't understand it, but you do reporting in trade magazines and such like. But I didn't know that you worked for the U.S. ambassador.
I did. It was 2009. I had just come back from almost a year in Bahrain.
Oh, yeah.
I was working for an investment bank down there doing public relations. And I came back, and it was just a temporary assignment. Usually the speechwriters for ambassadors are State Department employees, and I'm not a State Department employee. But I was asked to come in on a temporary basis, and I wrote for the ambassador at the time. The gentleman's name was Lou Sussman, and he was very close to Obama. It was one of Obama's biggest fundraisers, so it was an interesting time to be in the embassy.
Yeah, I bet. So you worked in the embassy here in the UK?
That's in London. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, cool. So what does it mean doing a speech? Does he say, "I want to talk about such and such and such and such," and then you turn that into words for him to actually read out?
Yeah, but here's the dirty little secret of it all is that while he signals what he wants to talk about, the actual core messaging that attaches to that comes from these places in the United States called the White House or the State Department, right? So it's not like he generates original thought on foreign policy or economic policy or anything. I just was very adept at scouting through the websites in the White House and the State Department to find out all the relevant speeches by the president, or at the time the Secretary of State was Hillary Clinton. So that made life even more interesting.
Okay, so when you do a speech, you're actually sort of just saying what the White House would want to say, coming out of the mouth of the ambassador.
That is right. Yes, correct.
Gosh. And I guess your job is to make it relevant to whatever event that he's currently at.
It is, and I don't want to suggest there wasn't some originality to it. I mean, if the first speech he delivered was a 45-minute long speech, nobody should speak 45 minutes, not even Fidel Castro. But we did put some original work into that. In the parts that applied into the UK market.
So this ambassador to the UK, we've got ambassadors all over the world in different countries, different places. The special relationship, inverted commas, is it still going? And did it ever go? Has it always been a myth? Is it a real thing?
Well, the answer to that lies somewhere between the cracks, okay? It's certainly a different relationship than the U.S. might enjoy with other countries. At the end of the day, we're allies. The U.K. and U.S. are allies.
Hmm.
What distinguishes the U.K. in terms of the alliance is that the U.K. is might be the only ally of the U.S. that has a significant enough military presence to matter and has the willingness to throw that military presence into actual combat situations, right? Germany, Japan, countries like that have militaries, but there's certainly Japan can't throw its military. It's forbidden by its constitution. Mm-hmm. And Germany is very stringent about where it applies military pressure. So it's the UK that has the military that the US needs, not for the actual firepower of the military. So let me back up a little bit. When Tony Blair went to Camp David with George W. Bush, the need on Bush's part to sell this to Blair was not predicated on the U.S. need for British military support. The U.S. has all the military it needs. It has the manpower, it has the air power, it has all the missiles, all the technology it needs. What it needed from Blair was a significant enough member to be on its side to start the coalition building.
As part of the UN, you mean?
Yes. And at the end of the day, there were something like 60 countries involved in the effort in Afghanistan, but very few of them had any kind of significant enough presence. I was looking at the list the other day, and there were countries that sent 130 men to Afghanistan.
Right.
So what Bush needed, he got from Blair, which was legitimacy for the effort, right? And I don't want to get too shrill about this, but what Bush needed was something to assuage the American public in the aftermath of 9/11. The American public was looking for some sort of jingoistic response, and Bush found it, right?
He delivered in the worst possible way, it seems to me, but that's an opinion. But and it's partially the root. Well, roots go way, way, way back, but it does seem to be the culmination in the last few weeks. The results of those actions are where we are now.
I think you're right. I think there was very little chance of us ever getting some sort of Afghan government in there that had enough credibility with the people to lead. History has shown that it's virtually impossible to defeat people who believe they are fighting for the freedom of their country. I think the United States learned that in a small little lesson in Southeast Asia, right? So did we seriously think we were going to overcome the Taliban? These guys are tough, and they know the terrain, and they're fighting for their country.
And they are Afghans as well. That's the other aspect of it, isn't it?
They are Afghans. Yeah.
Reading a little bit more deeply into it, finding that Taliban took over the area so quickly, partially because they have more support than the Americans do amongst the people of Afghanistan.
I think that's right. I think as brutal as the Taliban regime is, I think there were a lot of people in Afghanistan who saw that a better alternative than the complete dysfunctionality and high degree of corruption that the other civilian government displayed, and they wanted an end to that chaos. The alternative, of course, was something pretty draconian,
quite brutal. But it's sort of almost a democratic decision in a strange kind of way. People of Afghanistan having what they want as a majority of people.
Right. I'm not sure the women of Afghanistan would agree with that.
No, that's true. Indeed.
Right.
Well, that seems to be the victims of this situation, which, as always, will have been generated by men in the first place. That's another subject. But the effect is what was interesting to me was that we went into the Middle East all guns blazing, absolutely literally, as the US and the UK. We are leaving the Middle East, or have left the Middle East, very much not as a team. That it seems to be everyone for themselves. America's getting out, they're dealing with their people, and we're having to deal with our people because we've just followed on, it seems to me. That's where I'm quite interested in this. Has the special relationship changed over the period of since we went in? Which obviously it has, because it was a long time ago.
Well, I think you're onto something, and I think there's going to be a lot of analysis on what exactly happened in first of all, if you back up when Biden was the vice president, he was never in favor of these massive troop buildups in Afghanistan. He believed that our presence there should be solely focused on counterterrorism measures. Mm-hmm. So forget nation building, forget wiping out, you know, the Taliban or whatever, but just containing the terrorism potential within the country.
So something like an intelligence-based presence.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously that requires a much smaller face-off than what we had there.
Mm.
But here's what I haven't read anywhere, right? So in the absence of any kind of analysis on it, you can make up your own mind, is why did he choose to act with such speed and with such total contempt for his single biggest ally, right? This was not the Brits tried to talk him out of so quickly. He ignored them, and you know, the British were forced to scramble around trying to build a coalition of people outside the U.S. who might stay there for a little bit more orderly transition, and they simply couldn't do it. The militaries of foreign countries were interested, but they couldn't get it through their parliament. So, yeah, I can only imagine that what Biden wanted to do was move so quickly, and he didn't want to get hung up in any kind of logistical or operational niceties with others that would slow it all down. And talk about ignoring your allies at such a critical juncture. Somebody has to answer for this. Somebody has to explain this to the world, given all the chaos and nastiness and injuries and deaths that are occurring at that Kabul airport and are going to occur probably throughout the rest of the country if the Taliban really shows their true colors.
Mm. It seems odd that, you know, this is very much a Trumpian situation we've got, it seems. He was the one that negotiated with the Taliban in order to have the Americans exit. Not necessarily actually the wrong thing to be doing, but it seems, like you say, Biden wanted out very suddenly, very quickly. Right. Was he basing partially, do you think, this on the basis that he could blame Trump for all the trouble that gets caused because Trump initiated what's currently going on?
Well, if that's the case, I haven't seen it manifest in any way. What I have seen is some rather impartial political observers talk about Biden wanting to have the troops out of the country in order to make the 20th anniversary September 11th speech kind of all neat and packaged up and
oh,
said, look,
wow,
it's been 20 years and we're no longer out. We're out here. The mothers of America don't have to worry about us sending their sons and daughters to war. Right? So
it's a public relations exercise.
Well, I think there's a certain political expediency, let's put it that.
Gosh. Okay, let's switch into a bit of music to break up the conversation here, because it's big stuff, isn't it? The idea that Trump initiated this, Biden's running through with it, and the consequences, which we'll talk about after we've heard God of Number 9 from Sea of Wires. got a number 9, Sea of Wires, and we're talking of the current situation in Afghanistan. We're going to go on to the special relationship, but what happens now in Afghanistan, do you think?
Well, I think there's a, right now, that everybody's holding their breath about the arrangement to get people out of the country. There's an August 31st deadline, and there's been, just within the last 36 hours, all sorts of public utterances from the Taliban that they are not going to tolerate an extension of that deadline.
So they literally have about 7 days to get everybody out that they want to get out.
Yeah, now I don't know the total count, but I mean, the Americans, it's wild, the numbers that have been going out of there. I would estimate, just from kind of extrapolating on things, there's probably anywhere from 7,500 to 10,000 Americans left in the country. And that's not to, that's just the Americans. There's a lot of other, you know, foreign nationals in there.
Mm.
And if the Taliban, now, if the Taliban reach an agreement at a senior level, that's one thing. But if the Taliban feels, and there was some good reporting on this today in the Times of London by a friend of mine, Aunt Lloyd, who happens to be live in Cornworthy, so he's got a local connection.
Hmm.
But he was reporting about the interaction at the airport itself between American commanders and Taliban commanders. And the Taliban commanders are getting a little fed up with how chaotic it's become, because the Americans are letting more and more people through at a pace that's kind of disrupting the whole body politic around the airport.
Mm, the and actual physical the movement Taliban of people.
The Taliban does not want this chaos. And there was a story just 4 or 5 days ago. It was an alarmist piece. It said, could the Kabul airport be the next Dien Bien Phu for the Americans, right? The famous defeat of the French in Indochina. But I think we have to keep an eye out for that, because that could be ugly if it's not handled correctly.
So the immediate future is all about Kabul airport. And I guess there are troop landings or huge planes landing, picking people up, putting them in the hold and flying off. That you got the Americans and the Brits doing that.
Yeah, and I think there's others doing it. And what they're doing is they're not necessarily flying these people away to final destinations. They're flying them away to different positions within the kind of the immediate scope of the Middle East, Doha and Qatar and things like that.
All right.
The other thing to keep in mind is, now there's three regions up in the north of Afghanistan that have kind of turned back the Taliban, right? And while it might be nice at the moment to support those regions in some way, it would be suicidal to do that with the situation at the airport, right? The Taliban would just go mad.
Because they would be able to hold the airport to ransom if we intervene places to the north.
Right. And they would also read into that they couldn't trust the Americans. The Americans weren't going to hold up their word in terms of how this was all supposed to play out.
Mm. So this must be a huge embarrassment to the United States, with the biggest power of military on the planet being defeated effectively by the Taliban.
Well, it's an embarrassment, but B, it's really think of what the Russians and the Chinese. Now, the Chinese don't gloat as much as the Russians do, right? But Putin is just laughing his socks off at this.
Mm.
And the Chinese, by the way, the Chinese have had a relationship with the Taliban going back to 1999. The Chinese embassy in Kabul has never closed through this. And there are talks underway as we speak between the Chinese and the Taliban. So, we've given Putin grounds to laugh at us, and the Chinese will. The Chinese aren't going to get involved in the internal machinations of Afghanistan, but they're certainly going to do what they can to make sure it's stable, right? They don't, you know, there's something 46 miles of border the two countries share, and the Chinese do not want instability on their borders.
Mm.
So
in a humanitarian scope, that is a good thing.
Yeah.
And they might do a better job than the Brits and the Americans did in the first place. As you say, if they share a border, they're going to have more in common just through being locally based.
Yeah. Now, there's some inconsistencies here, right? We know that the Chinese don't always treat their Muslim citizens with the amount deepest of respect that's needed. Yeah. They're actually pretty impressive. And the Taliban has come in for a little criticism for the closeness of the relationship, given the Chinese, what the Chinese has done with its citizens. So, but, you know, they'll find a way to get along, I'm sure.
Wow. Fascinating. I'm not even going to go into the idea that our parliament were literally sleeping on beaches when all this was kicking off, but the idea that we've been left behind in terms of the process of escaping Afghanistan can't be ignored.
No, and then I saw just a headline 2 or 3 days ago that, you know, some of the Afghanis that we worked with weren't eligible to be removed from the country because they worked for outside contractors. I think that's criminal.
Yes.
That's criminal, but that's got to change. So.
In other words, tell me if I'm wrong on this. The idea being that if you have a translator and you'd got that translator through a company that provides translators, that translator is stuck.
Well, yeah, I think it's more. Yeah, that would be one phenomenon. I think the other is that if you had a translator who was working for a security company supporting the British, then they would be stuck.
Oh. Right?
Even though the benefit of that translator was directly transferable onto a British effort.
Oh, so third parties
worked
with the British could be very much in the firing line, literally, of the Taliban.
Yep, exactly.
Eek. So with the UK sort of fighting for itself here, there does seem to be an impression that the special relationship is at a very low ebb between America and Britain. And you can't help wonder if Brexit's got something to do with that, because the special relationship is both military and industrial and financial. And with London becoming less important as a money market to the Americans, they're going to be more allied with Europe from now on, I would have thought.
Let me try to explain it this way. One of the things that a country like America wants in terms of its foreign face-off is it wants as few a number of countries or alliances with which to deal, right? And so when Britain left the EU, it just created one more country on the list that it had to deal with, and it liked the fact that it could deal in the past, prior to Brexit, it could deal with 27 nations through one system. Mm. Henry Kissinger used to say, if I'm supposed to call Europe, if I need to deal with Europe, who do I call? Right? Well, the EU and that kind of gave face to that. And with England kind of coming out of it, it disrupted the whole flow.
Mm.
But on the bigger subject of the special relationship, I hate to say this, but it was created out of the UK's need in the aftermath of World War II to align itself as closely as it could with America, because America had usurped it in terms of its world power and its influence and its economic might. So Churchill in 1944 uttered it for the first time, and he did it as a way to kind of get into the slipstream of America so that England wasn't left behind in the post-war world. A lot of people have suggested the special relationship has really not benefited the UK to the degree it thinks it should have, right? It represents the UK as kind of a toady to the US, but it doesn't play up the individuality and the singularity of this country by making it so closely aligned with the US. I don't think it's really done it that many favors. And not to go beat this point too much over the head, there's a lot of elements of the special relationship that really aren't quite as clever as you might think. For instance, they bang on about the sharing of intelligence. Well, I hate to say this, but the U.S. doesn't need help in foreign intelligence gathering. Right. It's got all the manpower and all the technology it needs, right? It might need some stuff on domestic intelligence in the U.S. or the U.K., but that's really not a huge component of it.
So the actual intelligence they would be interested in is actually about the U.K. itself anyway.
I have to believe that, yeah. The answer is yes. Because the U.S. on its own can get the intelligence it needs anywhere in the world. Now, it's shown that it doesn't act very well on that intelligence. It can get it, but it doesn't always know what to do with it.
Fascinating. So it's kind of a one-way street, and always has been to some extent, because whilst I think probably, I'm guessing, because I don't actually know this, but I would imagine their main interest in the UK was that we were a financial power and a lot of money flowed through the UK, not necessarily into it, but through it in London. And now that's going to change with our new situation.
Well, yeah, but you're missing an element of that, right? Uh-huh. The element is that the U.S., through Wall Street, has been, over the years, doing everything it possibly can to take business away from the City of London, right? And so when Brexit became, a distinct possibility, the Wall Street investment banks were very keen to hire British traders and British investment bankers to kind of, facilitate the brain drain out of London. So there's no warm and fuzzy feelings between Wall Street and the City of London.
Right. So it's more to do with competition than it is to do with cooperation. Okay. Let's have a bit of music just to have a moment. And you've got Tom T. Hall. Who he?
First of all, he just passed away last week.
Oh,
he's a very, very well-known American country and Western artist who's kind of known as a storyteller. His songs are very storytelling in nature.
Okay, Fox on the Run then.
He walks through the barn leading down to the river. Her hair shone like gold in the hot morning sun. She took all the love that poor boy could give her and left me to die like a fox on the run. Like a fox,
like a fox,
like a fox on the run. Now everybody knows the reason for my fall. A woman tempted me down in Paradise Hall. This woman tempted me and she took me for a ride. Like a lonely fox, boys, I need a place to hide. She walked through the corn leading down to the river. Her hair shone like gold in the hot morning sun. She took all the love that a poor boy could give her and left me to die like a fox box on the run. Like a box,
like a box,
like a box on the run. Oh, we'll drink a glass of wine, boys, to fortify our soul. We'll talk about the world and the friends we used to know. I see a string of girls who have put me on the floor. The game is nearly over and the hounds are at the door. She walked through the corn leading down to the river. Her hair shone like gold in the hot morning sun. Oh, she took all the love that poor boy could give her and left me to die like a fox on the run. Like a fox,
like a fox,
like a fox on the run.
Fox on the Run by Tom T. Hall. God rest his soul. So the relationship between US and America, which is what we're talking about, in that we've now got Boris Johnson in charge of the United Kingdom. I'm not going to make comments on that. But the point was, I was thinking about the recent history of the relationship, inverted commas. Obama was none too keen on Theresa May, it seems, when they were working together. And Obama very specifically stated that he was more interested in dealing with Angela Merkel than he was with the UK. Does this mean that the actual relationship is done for? Is it finished?
Well, I don't think it's finished, but I don't think we're at a high spot here. I mean, going back to Obama, one of the things that distinguished Obama from other presidents was that he cared about cultural phenomena. I remember him making it clear to all the ambassadors around the world that he expected these embassies to be opened up to different cultural organizations that maybe had always dominated in the past. And so it was that the UK, the embassy in the UK, reached out to, schools and kind of, British African dance groups and all sorts of minorities that never would have gotten any airtime under previous ambassadors. And that was Obama's doing. So I could kind of see where Obama and Theresa May wouldn't have been, they wouldn't have been soulmates. They wouldn't have connected culturally. And I think that's important. I don't know. Biden and Johnson don't have great history, as you were pointing out in the break.
In the break, yeah. Just to clarify that, it was Johnson was a journalist in the early days, of course, and he's written some pretty racist things about. He was going on about Kenya, Obama, and he was also very sexist about Hillary Clinton as well. So that's not going to win him any fans with Biden.
So,
because Biden was vice president at the time, wasn't he? That's right.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah. So those things affect the relationship, right? We think of our leaders as almost impersonal blocks of granite making great decisions, but they're also men and women who are affected by all sorts of personal things, and I just can't see Biden and Johnson being much of a match. So,
If you wanted to have a drink with someone, you wouldn't choose your. You can't imagine those two sitting down together enjoying their company.
Because
with Johnson being a sort of mini Trump, that as Biden sees him. And probably the greatest of enemies in the States at the moment were Biden and Trump.
Yeah.
So exactly. not ideal for the future of the relationship. And does Brexit have an effect on the two countries, do you think? Is that just me being an anti-Brexiteer, or is it tangible that there is a difference that's going to happen because of it?
Oh, I think there. I think there very much is a difference. I think, I think this idea that Britain thinks America is going to kind of bend over and give it some sort of extraordinary trade deal is very naive. When it comes to that kind of stuff, America's as tough a negotiator as anybody else. And what I said before, I think applies, is that the Americans weren't really crazy about, you know, the whole European bloc now being split off even by one country. Mm. It would have been nice for everybody if America could have just dealt with one confederation. Mm. And now they have one more entity to deal with. But I don't care how special people think the relationship is. America's a practical country, as is Britain's a practical country. And the practicalities of this aren't real positive.
Mm. And this thing about we were sort of like a gateway to Europe, we've shut our own gates here, so we're no longer that. So we are now effectively dealing with America rather than as England and Europe or Britain and Europe. We're now dealing with America as just Britain.
Right.
And remember
that, and I don't want to be harsh about this, but what's happened to the British military in the last, I don't know, 5-10 years, as it's been shrinking, you know, and under-resourced, that doesn't suggest that America is going to be looking kindly at that either. America wants its allies to be robust in terms of their ability to not only defend themselves, but also join in these alliances with America to go overseas.
So hence, we spend a huge amount on military, but that's partially on the basis that we're a small country and we have to be relevant to the Americans in order for the relationship to carry on.
Mm, yes.
And that must be quite the pressure for a government to ensure that our military are well powered. Because you either do that or you accept that you're not going to be America's best mate anymore and start reducing that.
Yeah, but I think Britain's priorities should be British, not American. I think there's a way to fashion a military presence for the times that doesn't soak up quite as many resources, money, as this military has been taking. So
and I guess bombs don't play the same part they used to anymore. We don't just shoot at each other anymore from country to country or invade or things like that. That's sort of like a 20th century, 19th century construct that is no longer relevant to a large extent.
You're right.
So again, we're down to intelligence, but you've already revealed that intelligence is something the Americans don't get out of us very much definitions.
Yeah, they suggest they do, right? They would, you know, put it on the website. They put it in speeches, but I think that's more just for face saving a phenomenon than it is for the reality.
Mm. So. Well, it will be very interesting to see where things go from now. But the Afghanistan situation seems to have isolated that moment, and it sort of really sort of put a focus on the relationship between the two countries. And we'll just have to see how this pans out.
Yeah,
it'll be very interesting and quite frightening in a lot of ways. So thoughts and prayers. I hate that phrase with Afghanistan and the people there. But well, John, thank you. It's been absolutely fabulous to have a word with you this morning.
Well, Peter, it's always a pleasure.
And it's always a pleasure. Lovely to have you back on the show. And we've got to go because other programming is coming up on Sound Art Radio 102.5 FM. You've been listening to the full Totnes Breakfast, and we'll be hopefully back tomorrow. And this is the beautiful South and a little time.
I need a little time to think it over. I need a little space. on my own. I need a little time to find my freedom. I need a little.
Funny how quick the milk turns sour, isn't it? Isn't it? Your face has been looking like that for hours, hasn't it? Hasn't it? Promises, promises turn to dust. Wedding bells just turn to rust. Trust into mistrust.
I need a little room to find myself. I need a little space to work it out. I need a little room all alone.
I need a little room for your big head, don't you? Don't you? You need a little space for a thousand beds, won't you? Won't you? Lips say promise, feel the worst. Tongue so sharp, the bubble bursts. Just into
what's wrong? I've had a little time, and I still love you.
I've had a little time.